And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing. And to the man who would be king, I would say only one thing.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is B.R. Myers, who's a professor of international studies at Yongseo University in Busan, South Korea, and a contributing editor for The Atlantic and a columnist for The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal. He is the author of The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. Welcome to Background Briefing, Brian Myers.
Thank you, Ian.
And you've been quoted saying that the death of Kim Jong-il, the dear leader, comes at a very bad time, in as much as what, that they haven't had sufficient time to deify the successor, who I believe is now called the great successor?
Yes. Well, words like deify, I think, are one of the reasons why the West, I think, tends to misperceive North Korea. The perception that North Korea is a kind of religious cult is a little bit off the mark, in as much as a religious cult can name a successor from one day to the next, and the people have no choice really but to accept it and will accept it. I think the Unification Church was a good example of that a few years ago. North Korea is I think, similar to even to our Western democracies in the sense that that people cannot be made to believe something completely different from one day to the next. They need time. And the propaganda apparatus has kind of dragged its feet in glorifying this young man. There's been a lot of vague praise for him for the past 2 years, but the average North Korean still does not know very much about his life. Even the mythical details of his life are just not known to people here. And I'm sure that the regime was planning to do all that next year in the context of these 100th birthday of Kim Il-sung celebrations and so on. And now they're going to have to do it much quicker, at a kind of breakneck speed. And that's going to be quite a difficult task for them, I think.
Well, the North Korean official news agency has called upon the people and the military in North Korea to revere the respected comrade. So I guess deified is too strong, but reverence is something that
revere,
is...
Revere, yeah, greatly respect. A lot of this language is really language that the North Koreans inherited from the colonial period. These are the kinds of verbs and terms that were used in regard to Emperor Hirohito in the 1930s and 1940s, and the North Korean party simply Koreanified them in 1948, took them over.
So, Brian Myers, you're in South Korea. What is the sense there in the air? Is there any, there's always an expectation in these transitions that conservatives will have the upper hand. Is that an expectation on the part of South Korean authorities?
Well, I don't think that people should perceive North Korea as a country where the doves are battling it out with the hawks or where the conservatives are battling it out with the reformers. It's really not that kind of a state. It's one in which the executive has really managed quite successfully to monopolize ideology. You really don't find any significant ideological daylight, so to speak, between any of the parties in North Korea. So I don't expect any big ideological shift in the weeks or months ahead.
But surely the military plays a key role, doesn't it? It's a highly militarized state, and they get the lion's share of the meager resources in a country that 10% of its population have starved while it's been able to build nuclear weapons.
Sure. My point is only that the military and the party are pretty much on the same page. Remember, the party is still in power. The phrase military first is shorthand for the party puts the military first. It's not a military-run state. It's not a junta or anything. And the military has profited quite a lot from the controlled economy. There's a second military economy, which has made very many generals rich in North Korea, and they have no reason to want to bring on some unnecessary conflict that might bring the whole regime crashing down. So I think we're going to see the kind of unity, for the most part, that the regime is calling for right now.
So if they don't want to bring on an unnecessary conflict, what would a necessary conflict be? What is the justification? I understand that the justification for this perpetual militarized state with a high level of paranoia is that they look upon the U.S. as the occupiers, and they don't even consider the South Koreans a legitimate regime, and the Korean War is still in progress.
Right. Well, but again, the driving force for that is not the military, but the party and the actual leadership of the North Korean state, because that leadership is very well aware that there's really no reason for North Korea to exist as a separate state alongside South Korea, if it is not a military-first state. In other words, if North Korea were to disarm and make peace with the United States and South Korea, it would lose all reason to exist. It would simply become a third-rate version of South Korea, which is not an option for them. And I think it's very likely that they will try in the future to divert attention from their failures on the economic front by increasing tension with the outside world. And that could entail small-scale military attacks of the kind that we saw in 2010 in the Yellow Sea. I can foresee things like that happening again. I just would like to warn against the tendency of many people outside the peninsula to assume that the military is pushing all this, that these are generals who are just dying to use their weapons. And I don't think that's the dynamic that is driving things here.
So what is happening in South Korea at Brian Myers, again, professor of international studies at Dongseo University in Busan, South Korea, the author of The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. The conservative leadership in South Korea, I think in part, got elected on the notion that they've got nothing from the Sunshine Policy. It was a one-way street. And then that was reinforced, surely, by the sinking of the South Korean warship and the shelling of the South Korean island. Although there have been some gains, hasn't there, from the left in municipal elections in Seoul. So where do the politics stand?
Well, really, this is the baffling thing, I think, for Western observers, is that after each of those North Korean attacks, the opposition, the left-wing opposition, which has a very strong pro-North Korea element, won very big at the polls. The whole country really is shifting quite strongly towards the populist left at the moment. And I think this is something that needs to be factored in when people are trying to estimate the North Korean regime's chances for survival. If South Korea really were a rival state that were staking a claim to sole legitimacy over the entire peninsula with real conviction, I think the North Korean regime might be in more trouble. But you have here a South Korea that is in a deep crisis of confidence, where many people really consider North Korea to be the better of the two states.
The better of the two states? Based upon what?
Definitely. Based upon history, the South Korean people, particularly the intellectuals, are obsessed with the origins of the South Korean Republic, the first few years of South Korea. There's a general perception here that the country got off on a bad footing because it did not purge all the Japanese collaborators who were still in politics in the late 1940s. And a myth is quite prevalent here that North Korea made a clean break, that North Korea got rid of all its Japanese collaborators. And one of the things I've been trying to do in my research for the past few years is to point out that that's not the case, that Kim Il-sung purged landowners, but he welcomed intellectual collaborators to North Korea with open arms. And this is why the North Korean official culture that we see today, that we've been seeing for the past few days, is so similar to the official culture of Imperial Japan. The whole way in which the leader is venerated, that language that I was speaking of earlier, is language that was taken from the Japanese.
Well, you've pointed out in your latest book, The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters, Brian Myers, that we have read the entire political complexion of North Korea incorrectly as a communist regime reposed on the left.
Right.
You're arguing it's actually a right-wing regime.
It really is a very far-right state, and it annoys me when I keep hearing in the media broadcasts now talk about this communist North Korea. That is a word the North Koreans themselves no longer pay lip service to. They excised the last mention of it from their constitution in 2009. This is quite literally a nationalist socialist state, and if that elicits associations with the Third Reich, I'm sorry, but we have to face the facts. I would say in ideological terms, North Korea is really on the cusp between left and right. If you look at the political spectrum as a circle and not as a straight line, it's really right there on the cusp. And we need, therefore, to stop extrapolating from the Cold War when we try to deal with North Korea, and instead realize that it's much closer to our adversaries in the Second World War, even though it's not an expansionist nationalist state. The important thing is the implacability of its racial hatred of the outside world. This is something that is not going to change, and that indeed cannot be changed without the regime losing all reason to exist.
So, Brian Myers, what explains the copious weeping in the streets and on the television announcer announcing the death of the dear leader Kim Jong? Yes,
we tend to find it very strange when people cry on the streets because a political leader has died who's ruled them for 20 years, as opposed to people crying on the street because a pop singer has died or something, which is what we do in the rational West. I think that it's natural for people to cry in a situation like this. It's not simply a matter of mourning, though. I think to a large extent it's fear of the unknown. I've talked to many South Koreans, for example, who remember crying when the South Korean dictator Park Chung-hee was assassinated in 1979. Even though they didn't like him very much personally, they were simply afraid of what was going to happen to the country in this dangerous world after it had lost its helmsman, so to speak.
So what is the role of the éminence gris, the kind of Cardinal Richelieu there? Is it Biak?
Yeah, he's probably going to, if there is going to be any kind of power struggle in North Korea, it's going to be a power struggle over who gets to pull the strings behind this young man, or it's going to be a sort of a wrangling for his favor. But I think for the time being, it's definitely going to be his uncle, Chang Sung-taek, who's going to be running the day-to-day affairs of the country. I simply can't imagine that this very young man knows very much about how to handle all the different affairs. Whether it stays that way or not, I don't know. But I would imagine that the young man can work himself into the post.
And both the uncle and the young Kim Jong-un have both been made generals, right?
That's right, yeah. Chang Sung-taek is in the National Defense Commission, a very top post there. But I was just looking at the news yesterday when they were announcing the funeral proceedings, and Chang Sung-taek's name was actually quite far down the list. My guess is that they're probably going to be trying to downplay his importance to the North Korean people themselves and try to convey the impression that the young man is completely in control himself. A personality cult doesn't work otherwise.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary, though, isn't it, Brian Myers, that this very weak, isolated country, who've lost one-tenth of its population through starvation, yet manages to get the kind of attention they do, and many people argue that Kim Jong-il outfoxed George W. Bush. What explains that, the strength in their weakness?
I would agree that that he outfoxed George W. Bush, particularly in the last year of the Bush presidency, when the Americans were just desperate for a deal and the North Koreans were exploiting that to the hilt. I think the world, greatly underestimated Kim Jong-il as a playboy when he first took over. And when you think of what he did with the economic cards and political cards he was played in the 1990s, he certainly turned out to be a more adept and skillful leader than his father had been. As for the success of the state, as for how it continues to survive, again, the explanation can be found in the North Korean ideology, about which far too little has been said in the past few days in the American media, the ideology of race-based nationalism. If you look at the Third Reich, for example, there was no support for surrender in the Third Reich until the very last day of the Second World War. The German people were quite willing to go right into the apocalypse because the regime had done such a good job of equating itself with the race. This is the one thing that far-right regimes do so well. And in North Korea as well, even people who don't like the regime, I found this when I was traveling through the country in June, even people who show no real enthusiasm for the regime itself are very enthusiastic about the state. They're very patriotic, in other words. And this is something I don't encounter in South Korea. When South Koreans look at their flag and their eyes well up with tears, they're thinking about the race. They're not thinking about the Republic of Korea. So in that sense, North Korea has a very strong state loyalty advantage, and I don't expect that to change in the next couple of months.
So there's no disconnect then in the people's mind between the Juche philosophy, which is one of self-reliance, and the fact that the state can't feed its own people?
Well, the Juche ideology is basically a pseudo-doctrine that was cooked up in the early 1970s in order to give Kim Il-sung something else to boast about. That was the time the Cultural Revolution was in full swing in China, and the North Koreans were afraid of being infected by Maoism. They were afraid their own people would start to look to Beijing for ideological guidance. And that was when this grab bag of humanist truisms was thrown together, and among them was the notion of self-reliance. But the North Koreans have never considered that to be especially important. I compare the North Korean economy always to the Japanese hikikomori, who are these young men who refuse to leave their rooms and their parents have to bring food and leave them in front of the door. North Korea is really like that. It doesn't want to be self-reliant. It wants to be isolated. And if taking international aid is going to help its isolation, it takes it very greedily. But if it needs to open up to the outside world in any way in order to improve its economy, it won't do that. So it's isolation that they want more than self-reliance. And North Korea has managed to remain very well isolated, even now with all the Chinese investment in the country. It's still pretty well sealed off from the outside world.
And you were saying earlier, Brian Myers, that in effect we've got a lot of things wrong about North Korea, but what we have also got wrong, I think, is that the assumption's always been that the South would reunify the North if the North collapsed, just as West Germany took in East Germany. But you're suggesting in a way that the North Koreans, they believe the opposite, right? That they will liberate the South, and that they've got a lot of support in the South in that kind of mythology.
Yeah, I think the North would be misperceiving South Korea if they thought that there was genuine, wide, sort of mainstream support for North Korea in the South. That's certainly not the case. The problem, though, and this was, of course, what caused the Korean War in 1950, the problem is that the North Koreans are capable of misperceiving the situation. The South Koreans in 2010, I think, really did make the mistake of conveying to North Korea an unwillingness to defend themselves. You had those two attacks, the one attack on the South Korean ship and the one attack on the populated South Korean island. Neither of them led to even a fraction of the kind of indignation that we see in North Korea whenever the Japanese make some formal reiteration of their claim to the disputed Liancourt rocks. In other words, the South Korean people only get indignant when they feel that the race itself has been insulted by an outside power. They don't get particularly angry or indignant at the things the North Koreans do. What little anger there was after the attack on the island last year dissipated in about a week. And the problem with that, of course, is that if you're Kim Jong-un and you're sitting up there in Pyongyang surrounded by yes men and you've been raised inside this personality cult, there's a strong likelihood that you will misunderstand the South Korean situation and think that perhaps the South Korean people might not fight back. I think that's the danger, which is being overlooked a little bit too much by experts.
Well, just in closing, Brian Myers, China is always considered to be the key here if there's to be any kind of, not so much reunification, but any ending to the Korean War and a dialing down of the perennial tensions there between the two and the militarization of that border. My understanding is that the Chinese don't particularly want the North to collapse. They don't want the U.S. Army on the Yalu River. But what do they want?
They would probably like the status quo to continue indefinitely. Let's remember, China's number one task at the moment, economically speaking, is to secure resources for its people for the long term. And they've signed an awful lot of very sweet deals with North Korea, according to which they're extracting the country's very rich natural resources for a song. And the last thing they want, I think, is for the regime in North Korea to collapse. It's not just the American troops on the Yalu, but of course, the refugee problem and all these things that they associate with regime collapse. And I think this is where most of our diplomatic energy and resources need to go in the future, not just America's, but South Korea's as well. They need to go towards persuading Beijing that a unified and unified Korean peninsula would not be against its interests.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us from South Korea, Brian Myers.
Sure thing, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with B.R. Myers, who's a professor of international studies at Dongseo University in Busan, South Korea. He's a contributing editor for The Atlantic and a columnist for The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal. He's the author of The Cleanest Race, How North Koreans See Themselves and Why It Matters. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in a moment talking about the real architect of the Iraq War.
This is a war we can win.
After 10,000 years, it's still us against them, and my heroes have always died at the end. So who's going to account for these sins?